This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I probably will come in for a little bit tomorrow to my major client, but I got some things to do tomorrow. I thought, you know, we might as well get this done today. It is episode 16. I can't believe it's been that many episodes already. And still I have things to talk about. As I told person one time, yes, I find myself very amusing, so I can talk for a long time. At the end of last week's podcast, if you were listening, I will admit to, yes, I was rushing like crazy. I was trying to get to a wedding, and in fact, I did get to the wedding, and it was a really lovely wedding. There were only a few that had been provided, or had been invited, and it really was quite touching and tender. There was about 30 of us there. The groom and the bride had been separated for, I think, several years. Of course, they talked over Skype a lot. There were visa issues, you know, some drama there. Eventually, that all worked out, and she was able to travel to America, and they were able to get married, and it just really was lovely. There came one spot towards the end when we were getting ready to go our separate ways that he sang a song for her, and it was a song that he had specifically written for her and put on a CD and had given to her many months before and had said, I know we're going to be apart for a long time, but take this CD with you, and whenever you miss me, play this CD. Know that I'm thinking about you and I'm loving you. You know, and anyway, he sang this song and he was having trouble getting through the song and he was crying and she was crying and we were crying. So it really was lovely. It really was very lovely. At the end of last week's podcast, I did sort of start into a topic that I thought, I shouldn't have started into that because there is no way I'm going to be able to address this. And I kind of floundered around and left. And specifically that topic was how wonderful it would be if we had creators in the world who are immensely popular and who also pointed people towards lives of success instead of many times what we see where we have people who are immensely popular and idolized, and in fact they end up living lives that don't necessarily show us how to create an environment of success, and oftentimes distract people from creating environments of success for their lives. And I'd like to elaborate on that just a little bit. There's not enough time to go over that whole topic, but maybe sometime we'll talk about it. Just some things to think about in that. I don't know if any of us would be able to survive the kind of level that someone like a Michael Jackson is at or was at, or someone like an Elvis Presley. And I don't know how any of us would necessarily survive that type of adulation. I know it would be very, very difficult. But in addition to that, I think that perhaps a person doesn't necessarily get to that level of adulation without there being something that the flesh in the worshipers, in those who adore, something in the flesh in them that can twist and idolize that person. Because the process of idolizing is really, obviously, a process of idolatry. And that is simply to set something up that I then am going to worship. And that process is oftentimes driven by flesh, because we are ignoring the one who we could worship, the master designer, the one who wants a true relationship with us of success, and we are replacing him with other things, be it food, be it music, be it actresses, yada, yada, yada. And so since that process can be flesh-driven to begin with, because the kind of idolatry, the type of idolizing that I'm talking about is obviously beyond simply an appreciation of creativity. I can look at Michael Jackson and say, there is a guy who was an amazing talent. I told somebody this last week, there's a guy who, in my estimation, was our generation's Chopin or Mozart, because everyone who worked with him said that he was a fabulous talent in terms of musically and composing, and certainly an amazing talent in terms of dance. And we can appreciate that, we can celebrate that without idolizing someone. But in fandom, there's a step that goes above that, of course, where you get to idolize. And since that is driven by flesh, I wonder if the flesh will not drive a person to idolize someone else whom is putting forth a message of success. In other words, if there's someone that is really has his stuff together and is showing people how to live lives of epics and quests and adventure, and is going out and being a creator and is experiencing all that life has, that person is not really going to have a whole lot of extra energy to lay around and go, oh, I just want to listen to that music again. You know, I mean, that person is going to be out doing things. And so I think in order to may perhaps inspire that level of idolizing, you actually have to have something on the creator's side that will inspire that. Now, there's certainly those who seem to be trying to make the attempt to do their craft, do their art, to have their epics and their quests, and yet maintain some sort of moral standards. Not knowing them directly, I can't say how much is really happening on the inside, but at least on the outside, the press seems to be that the Jonas Brothers, who obviously are extremely popular, are doing just that. And so I wish them all the best. And I really hope that as this process continues, that they are able to maintain that. Although, honestly, it would not surprise me if they didn't, because the pressures at that level are very, very intense. I find it very interesting that Jesus, whenever he is faced with a situation where people are moving from listening to him to moving to more of an idolizing or an idolatry stance, he pulls away. He feeds the 5,000, and the people think, this is great! We don't have to work anymore. We'll just follow this guy around. We'll call him our king and he'll feed us. Yeah, well, so they get ready to make him their king and Jesus just slips away. Same thing happens at the Pool of Bethesda. Jesus comes in, heals somebody, there's stuff stirring up, and he just slips away. And at one point, the Gospels even record that he didn't give himself to them because he didn't need their testimony. In essence, he knew who he was and he knew what was in them. And so he was not going to put himself in a position, to use my terminology, is not going to put himself in a position where he would garner their idolization. Now, obviously, there's a whole bunch more that can be said about that, but I did just sort of blow through that really fast last week and then said, okay, see you, bye. And so I just wanted to touch that. And like I said, maybe we'll get back later sometime and talk about that a little bit. What I did say we would talk about this week is Project Natal. And in case you haven't heard about Project Natal or don't know what it is, it is a new mechanism for controlling video games that is supposed to be coming out for the Xbox 360. It is very cool from a gaming perspective, but there are some aspects of it that I thought it would be great if we just spent a little time chatting about today. Because we've talked about the lessons we can learn from the natural world. and how that the master designer, the eternal, whatever you want to call him, has actually designed this world to teach us very important lessons about how to create success. And we've talked about the lessons that we can learn in the imaginary world because God gave us the ability to be creators and create worlds and have those worlds consumed by others, and the fact that those worlds, as they are consumed by others, are going to teach lessons. But I think the virtual world really kicks all of this up a notch. And I think Project Natal, if it gets to the place where it delivers as advertised, is going to kick it up a notch again. And I think it really is good for us to recognize some of the mechanisms that are involved, not so that we will say, oh, it's evil, you can't, you have one of those in your house, it's like the one-eyed devil. I mean, we used to, you know, when television first came in, a lot of the preachers were really not too thrilled with it, and they did have a point. Certainly, they saw how that television was bringing images into households that never would have been brought into those households before. Yes, that's true. But to just completely make a blanket statement and throw out the technology is not helpful, because it's really hard for us to be in the world and be interfacing with the world if we're somehow just throwing out the new technology, because there's a component of that technology that very much is the result of this wonderful image of God that we have within us and of this creative spirit, and we should be celebrating that. Television's cool. I mean, you can see lots of cool stuff on television. You can see lots of stuff that's not so great on television, too. And so I think we just need to be wise about technology and see what it supplies, understand what's coming at us, understand how we should respond to that without just saying, technology's evil. So that's my whole point, is just to look at this and say, okay, let's be wise about what's happening internally in us when we engage in these things. And as long as we can keep those things in our mind, we can see what's happening, we can judge the good from the bad, we can celebrate, along with the rest of the people who use the technology, that it is very cool. And Project Natal is one of those things. Now, we should probably back up a little bit before we talk about Project Natal and just sort of set the stage in terms of the virtual world, because Project Natal is not an isolated advance. There are things that have been happening all along that dovetail into what a certain segment of the people who are developing for Project Natal are trying to do. And I personally would trace the beginnings of this certain segment back to the 60s. There was a man named Joseph Wiesenbaum, I think is his name, that from 1964 to 66 actually developed a program called ELIZA. And if I recall correctly, ELIZA was actually one of the first class of programs that the geeks called chatterbox programs. What chatterbox programs do is you sit in front of a computer and you type into a computer and you just type in something, and the chatterbox program says something back to you. And the trick is to make the chatterbox program good enough that you don't realize it's just a computer on the other end. There isn't actually anyone there. One of the first attempts at this, Joseph Wiesenbaum made, was to use a standard psychoanalytical approach that you just take whatever the person says and you turn it around and you give it back to him. So this ELIZA program was a very clever parsing program. It would do things like, if you would sit down and say, my head hurts, it would say, why do you say your head hurts? I mean, it has no intelligence at all. All it's doing is just taking your stuff and turning it around and putting it back to you. And I went out and played with one of these this week, and it's the simplest thing in the world just to make this thing, it just say stupid stuff to the point where you realize there's no human there. But one of the things that surprised its creator was the fact that people who used this didn't necessarily understand that. That they very quickly gave this little chatterbox program their trust, and they began to treat it as if it was a real human being in which they were confiding. And all it's doing is it's regurgitating their words back to them. If I recall, there was one story that Wiesenbaum told about coming in to his office one day, and apparently his secretary had carried on an extended conversation with Eliza, and when he came in, she leaned forward to shield the monitor from his eyes, because she had the feeling that she was in a private session with a therapist. And Wiesenbaum, I think, was quoted as saying that he was always stunned when he'd ask to see the transcript, and people would look at him like, well, this is my private, you know, therapy session. What do you mean? And what we see in that is a tendency for people very quickly to assign a level of confidence that is equal to a level of confidence that they would have in a confidant, a human confidant. It's very easy for people to slip into this, and I would suggest that the reason that it's easy for people to slip into this is because the flesh is always looking for ways to isolate people. So it's very aware of the fact that this is not a human being, and if it can get you to spend time talking to this computer program that really is just reflecting back to you who you are and what you want to say, it can get you isolated and get you tied up in that isolation so that you don't have real human interaction. And if it can cut off your real human interaction, it is much easier for the flesh then to lead you down the path that it wants to lead you down. Another piece of this that shocked me several years ago was in June of 2003, I think, there was a DVD that was released that was a companion to the Matrix movies. It was called Animatrix. And the first little animated short in that were these two animated people on the supposed, you know, jacked in virtual environment, where they were having this samurai sword thing and basically slowly cutting each other's clothes off. And I told my kids and my wife after I saw that, I said, okay, look, this is the end of the world as we know it. Because at that point, we were getting to the point, at least that was my first exposure, of getting to the point where 3D digital graphics were looking good enough to be desirable. And I was thinking, okay, you know, when we get to this point where people can sit here and just play games and it looks this realistic, that's going to usher in a whole new level of the flesh using this to isolate. Now, there's more stuff that we could talk about, but that's just a quick background of progression that I see when we talk about something like Project Natal. Okay, Project Natal, which I'm assuming Natal stands for natal or birth or newborn, is a controlling device that allows you to simply use your arms and legs to control video games. So you wave a hand and your avatar on the screen waves a hand, because Project Natal has two little cameras, and I'm not sure if they do it with infrared or how they do it, but it is cool. You wave your hand and the avatar on the screen waves its hand, and so they're doing full body mapping. In addition to that, they can do facial recognition. In addition to that, there's some pretty good voice recognition. And this can all be used to play games without having to actually hold a controller. which is cool. But that's not necessarily the aspect of it that made me rock back on my heels and go, ooh, wait a minute. The aspect of that that really rocked me back on my heels was a project with a virtual character named Milo that was trying to bring together in synergy all the different components and pieces that Project Natal had to offer. And in this demo, which I understand a lot of it's scripted and a lot of this doesn't work yet, but at least they're showing what their vision is and they're showing that things are getting closer. In this demo, a woman walks up to the screen. She greets Milo, this little boy who's on a swing. He gets up out of the swing on the computer screen. He walks towards the woman. He recognizes the woman. They begin to have a natural conversation. He is reacting to her emotions. He says, let's do something. They go over to play a little game. He throws her some goggles. She reaches out to catch these goggles because that's just an instinctive thing that she does because she's already emotionally vested in this. She puts on the goggles. She leans over to look at the water wearing the goggles. You see her reflection in the pond because it's taken a picture of her and mapped her reflection there. She catches some fish. Milo is supposed to draw pictures of the fish. He doesn't know how to draw pictures of the fish. She takes a physical piece of paper, draws a picture of the fish on the physical piece of paper, holds it up to the cameras that are in Project Natal. Project Natal recognizes it as a piece of paper. I'm getting my mail. Recognizes it as a piece of paper, scans it, creates a piece of paper that Milo then reaches up and grabs and brings down, and it has her drawing on it. And now he says, oh, I understand how to draw fish. And so then he can draw fish. Now, okay, this is amazing technology. This is really cool. There's no question about that. This is cool. But what we have here is a completely virtual character where the creator's vision is to create something that is totally interactive, someone you can go on adventures with, someone who will reflect your emotions. And I see this as being very cool and handy and neat. I'm backing into the garage. But I also see this as an opportunity, certainly for the flesh, to say, oh, well, there you go. I'd rather play with this. And so the flesh, I can see an opportunity here for the flesh that if these characters and if these companions do come about, that the flesh will just go, well, great, and just love to have you spend time with this character because this character will always recognize you. This character will remember what you talk about. This character will want to talk about the things you want to talk about. This character will entertain you, potentially. This character will interface with something like an aggregating news service. So this character can go out and find stories that it thinks you're interested in, so it can feed you the news stories that it thinks would be interesting to you. Do you see how having this type of capability, this type of interactivity with a virtual character can be very appealing? And the thing about this virtual character is it never ages. And it can look like anything you want. And you know as well as I do, it's not going to end with a little boy. Or for some people, it will. Now then, does that mean that the technology is evil? Of course not. The technology is not evil. The technology is very cool. However, we have to recognize that the virtual world has a capability unlike other imaginary worlds to be very enticing. and to draw us in and to isolate and to us encourage us in modes of living which aren't necessarily successful. A buddy of mine said that he was talking to the security staff at a major convention area, and there was some big gaming convention that was coming in. I forget what it was. All I remember is the story, and hopefully I've gotten it right. And he was talking to the security official about it, and the security official was not thrilled about this gaming convention coming in. Because he said, the whole time the convention is going to be, there's just going to be people laying around playing games. And he said they laid around in the halls and would play their handheld gaming games for so long that they would get to the place where they would just urinate on themselves because they didn't want to stop playing their game. Now, okay, I grant you that's an extreme case, but I say that simply to say the virtual world has this capability to draw us in because it's interactive, because creators can entertain us and make it exciting. But the creators that are creating these virtual worlds aren't necessarily trying to craft them to teach us lessons that will lead to success in our lives. They're crafting something that will be entertaining and engaging and immersive, and they're trying to get you to spend as much time as possible there. So I just caution us. I mean, I like to play video games as much as the next person does. And for a while, I was spending quite a bit of time playing video games. But I did it for a very specific purpose. For a while, every Wednesday night, I would get home. And I would get online with Xbox 360 because I finally had high-speed internet. And my son-in-law would get on his Xbox 360 at his house, and we would play Halo. And the reason that I did that wasn't necessarily just to play Halo. I did it to play Halo with him. Because we could talk back and forth to each other as we were playing Halo. We could have a shared experience with him. And it was fun. And when it came to the point that he had other things to do and, you know, we couldn't get together as much, I quit playing Halo. Because I had other things that I could accomplish with that time. I've got my own quest, my own epic. I have my writing. I have things to do. I don't just need to be entertained. Not that there's anything wrong with being entertained occasionally. But if you find that it's robbing you of time that you could spend creating, of time that you could spend pursuing your epic and your quest and your adventure, then I think I would take another look at it and see if you couldn't spend that time better in other areas. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.